Our show's name pays tribute to the Boer Trekkers of South Africa, who in 1838 soundly defeated 30,000 Zulus on the bank of the Nkomo River, thereafter called Blood River, from the water turning red with the blood of the slain. Miraculously, no Boer Trekker died and only three were wounded. Now, your friend, Eddie Miller, will be your ambassador for tonight's show.
Dear Blood River Radio family, hey man, we made it to the third hour. I survived the VA, and guess what? We got the general himself, Bitter Indra, coming here fresh out of the battlefield. I know, y'all, we've always complained about it. The Bitter Indra just helling him sores. But you know what? As long as he keeps going through these Yankees like he has, we'll continue to supply the swords. But it would be nice if he could make one sword last a lot longer than one battle once in a while. But anyway, Bitter Ender, I tell you what, you just came in and you still got mud on your boots and the horse. I hope you didn't put the horse up without carrying him down. I know your pistols are still hot from firing and everything in the battlefield. But what do we got going to the guys tonight? To the
Well, Eddie, I almost didn't make the program tonight. I was getting ready to go to downtown Nashville for the big protest and jump in there with our Flamin' Fairy Mayor Flamin' Freddie O'Connell, one of the worst politicians we've ever had. And I can't wait for the ICE to come in here and handcuff him and haul him out of the courthouse. But yeah, I was all set to go in and be in that a big protest. They were saying no King Day, and I thought they were going to get rid of that damn Martin Luther King holiday. I was all fired up for that, and then no, they're calling Trump King, and it was a protest against Trump. I didn't have all my facts straight, so no, it wasn't a protest against Martin Luther King Day. It was they're calling President Trump the King, and that was a protest against him. So anyway. No, I want to get rid of that damn holiday. It's another one that was foisted off on us by the stinking federal government, another one of their Monday holidays. And the thing that really ticks me off about that is, in the state of Tennessee, we used to have three Confederate holidays, state holidays, banks, businesses, state government shut down. January 19th, Robert E. Lee's birthday. June the 3rd, Jefferson Davis' birthday, which is also a Confederate Memorial Day in Tennessee. Oh, Lord of mercy, can't do that anymore. And July 13th, Nathan Bedford Forrest's birthday. So when they crammed that mugging, looting, and killing day down our throats, they got rid of all our Confederate holidays. And the reason being, we had a bunch of sorry, worthless Democrats that controlled the Tennessee General Assembly. And they had a few decent Democrats in there. But, you know, they were totally outvoted, and there weren't that many Republicans that were in office in Tennessee then. The Democratic Party hadn't got that crazy, and we were still a Democrat majority in our state house and governors. And so once Lyon Lyndon flipped the Democrats over to the nutcase side, then that's when Tennessee went Republican and elected our first Republican governor, Winfield Dunn, and gosh, I don't know, probably since Reconstruction that we had a Republican as governor. So anyway, but unfortunately, that wasn't the King Day they were protesting against. So anyway, so I couldn't go down there and march with all the flamers and the illegal taco heads and the blacks that were marching and you know, robbing a convenience store at this block and tearing up everything in Walgreens at the next block and smashing the windows and taking whatever they wanted at the next block. So I had to miss out on all that fun and games. So anyway, hey, what you were talking about. Oh, speaking of all the riots, yes. This is an interesting observation I've made. You know, Gavin Newsom and that goofy-looking, skin-headed black whatever that thing is, it's mayor of Los Angeles, yapping and whining and crying about, oh, they don't want the National Guard in here. Oh, and federal troops. Oh, they're sending federal troops in here to keep order.
Yes.
Well, they're not going to. They don't want that. They don't want that. All right, let's flash back to the late 1950s and early 60s. Those liberals were jumping up and down and wetting their pants. They were so happy about troops coming into Oxford, Mississippi, and Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
Little Rock, Arkansas?
And Little Rock, to try to destroy our public school system and drag our universities down to the level of the black colleges and universities. Now, here's the big argument. They said, oh, we just want to go to the famous white school, the top university in Mississippi or the top university in Alabama. We just want to be like everybody else. Oh, boo-hoo, boo-hoo. As soon as they got there, they started griping about the Confederate flag playing Dixie. There weren't enough black studies programs, which meant that's not an education at all. It's worse than basket weaving or something like that, you know, just a skate to get all the athletes through the school. So, yeah, that was okay when they used federal troops in the South, but when they used federal troops out in California to stop actual riots, Governor Wallace in Alabama, Governor Barnett in Mississippi, and Governor Faubus in Arkansas,
yes,
they weren't tearing up anything and burning anything to the ground and setting police cars on fire and looting stores and doing all of that. They just wanted to protect our school system. And they knew what was going to happen when they had forced integration. Those Kennedy bastards couldn't wait to send the troops into Oxford or Tuscaloosa. So anyway, that really turned me against the federal government back there in the
60s. You know,
so
Gene,
anyhow,
one quick note. If I had my brothers, I think it was the 101st Airborne that Eisenhower sent
to
Little
Rock.
I think
Eisenhower did that.
Yes.
Yeah.
I would have if I could do it, I would take the 101st and the Arkansas National Guard. I don't know what troops, federal troops that JFK sent. It may be just the National Guard, but I would take the Guard from Little Rock, Arkansas, Oxford, Mississippi, Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and the 101st, and I would send them in there, like thumb in their eye, to payback, baby. Send them into California. But that's just a comment
exactly.
I want to make, Ginger. Yes,
and tell
sir.
Them take no prisoners. Order them once to halt, and then shoot to kill.
That's
what they used to do with looters. People were breaking into stores and looting stores. The police used to do that. You ordered them once to halt. If they didn't halt, then you shoot to kill.
That's
of course, they can't do that today. If they did that today, the Democrats would lose all their voters. So you can't do that.
One last question for you before we go. I've got to ask you this. Is Trump, is this Gavin Newsom, is he going to get a little bit more out of line? Do you think Trump, and I got to shut the hell up after this, because I know you got a lot to cover. Do you think Trump's going to have him arrested? Will he arrest the governor of the state of California, Gene?
You know, there's a possibility of that. For violating, violating federal laws and using these rioters to attack federal buildings. Now, I don't think they could have him arrested if he just sat around with his thumb stuck up his rear end and let all the looters and rioters destroy private businesses in California. But if they start going after federal property, they've got every right to arrest him. And he's encouraging people and not doing anything to help or interfering with the National Guard that's been or the state California Guard that's been nationalized or the Marines from down at Camp Pendleton. If he's messing with that, he's crossing over the federal line there. They could have him arrested. But just tearing up, downtown Los Angeles or setting Malibu and the Palisades on fire. Oh, no, wait a minute. They've already burned that. They can't burn it again. Anything like that. I don't think he could do that. But
if he aids and abets, maybe.
But anyway,
I hope I didn't throw you off too bad, but I just had to ask.
No. Well, that's in the news. We got to cover the current events. So, but another current event, we want our listeners to know what happened on the 10th of June, which was Tuesday. And not the 10th of June in 2025, but the 10th of June in 1864. And this is going to be a military history lesson on the brilliance of Confederate General Nathan Bedford Forrest and how he fought this battle on the 10th of June that is still studied in military schools today all over the world. They don't say who it is, of course. Can't do that. But they go through this battle detail by detail, and I think most knowledgeable military people know exactly who they're talking about, and show how a much smaller force can defeat a much larger force. So with that, we'll get into it. So here we are, spring of 1864. Grant has been called east to take on Robert E. Lee in Virginia, and the Western Army has been turned over to William the Torch Sherman, and his main campaign is to move out of Chattanooga and head down the Western Atlantic Railroad to Atlanta and take Atlanta. Now, they want Atlanta to fall, and Richmond, too, if they could, but it's imperative that they show some kind of success before the November elections, because in the spring of 1864, the war wasn't a done deal. There was no guarantee that Grant was going to be successful, and neither Sherman either. So we'll come back. That's the way it was laid out in the spring of 64, and we'll pick up our details after we come back from the break.
Thank you, Bill Renner. Be right back, folks.
Do you know what is great about America? Ask an Immigrant. Ask an Immigrant is a new podcast dedicated to helping Americans, especially our youth, value, appreciate, and be grateful for the freedoms we have here in America. Join host Lydia Wallace Nuttall as she interviews immigrants from around the world to discover their inspiring personal stories about why they came to America. To learn more about why America is the most prosperous, greatest country in the world, download the Loving Liberty app or go to lovingliberty.net.
Blood River Radio is the only news media in the United States whose sole purpose of being is to fight against the ever-rising tide of global white genocide, both soft and hard genocide, whether it is in the form of ethnic cleansing via the current massive invasion of non-white, non-Christian hordes that are overwhelming the once all-white nations of Western Europe, the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the United States, or via the hard genocide in South Africa, where the rape, murder, and torture of whites is an ongoing daily occurrence. Though we are a Christian brotherhood, we will cooperate with other groups in our operations if it will shorten our people's casualty list. We further pledge to you to leave the radio studio at every opportunity and take it to our churches, to our universities, and most importantly, we promise to occupy the streets. However, none of our mission can succeed without funding. Please help us all that you can and donate to our cause by going to www.bloodriverradio.com.
In the medical field, IT security is crucial. Our highly skilled consultants are HIPAA certified and have 20 plus years of experience servicing medical clinics, billing, and supply companies. We offer comprehensive endpoint protection, guarding your computers and servers against all stages of threats. And with our 24/7 monitoring services, you'll never worry about extensive downtime again. Ready to level up your IT support? Call 801-706-6980 today and discover how great IT services can be with Managed IT Services.
Smell of napalm in the morning. Smells like victory.
Some folks are born made to wave the flag. Cool, they're red, white, and blue.
Dear Blood River Radio family, I'm really excited to hear this. Time is short. I'll go right back to the bitter end. We're talking about this. Thanks. It's going to be General Nathan Bedford Forrest's greatest victory. Go ahead, bitter end. Tell us all about it.
Okay, we were recapping the military situation in the South in the spring of 1864. We said Grant had gone east to try to take on Lee. Sherman was in Chattanooga, and his next objective was moving down the railroad to Atlanta. So Sherman, the Confederate government could never recognize how good Forrest was, but our enemies did. Sherman was deathly afraid that Forrest was going to come roaring out of Mississippi into Middle Tennessee and take out these two single-track railroads, the Nashville and Decatur, which Decatur's due south of Nashville across the Tennessee River, or the Nashville and Chattanooga, which runs at an angle from, you know, southeast down there and then hooks up with the Western and Atlantic all the way down to Atlanta. So he was definitely afraid of that. And they couldn't use the Tennessee River for supplies with all their gunboats and stuff in the summertime because of Muscle Shoals, Alabama. And they hadn't built Wheeler Dam, of course. That wasn't until the WPA projects. So in the summertime, the river would get low, and across those shoals, you couldn't get big boats going upstream there. So Sherman had to rely on the railroads. So his strategy was, and the Union strategy was, and it was approved by Washington, of course, was to keep Forrest busy in Memphis and Mississippi and out of Tennessee. So Forrest could read a map as well as anybody, and he was ready to head out of Mississippi and go after these railroads. What happened was on June the 1st, Forrest and his command left Tupelo, Mississippi on June the 1st. He had 2,400 men and six cannons. General Samuel Sturgis, the Union commander, left Memphis on June the 2nd, headed into northern Mississippi. He had 8,300 troops, 22 pieces of artillery, and 250 wagons to scour the countryside and rob whatever food they could find from the civilians in northern Mississippi, plus anything of value that they wanted to take. And they had a large contingent of black soldiers, USCTs, with this federal army coming out of Memphis. And they had all these paper notes pinned on their uniforms that said, "Avenge Fort Pillow, no quarter to Forrest men." Because you remember back in April, the Battle of Fort Pillow had been fought over on the Mississippi River. And the North had gemmed up this propaganda garbage about the massacre at Fort Pillow. So fake news is not a recent phenomenon. It was going on back in the 1860s as well. And so all these blacks were going to get revenge on Fort Pillow. So anyway, they're headed out into northern Mississippi to go after Forrest. So the cavalry commander in Mississippi was Stephen D. Lee. And when they got word that this huge federal force was coming out of Memphis and headed to northern Mississippi, they sent word to have Forrest turn around and come back into Mississippi. Now, this is a strategy error that the Confederates made. The Confederate government, I think, and historians have said this, the Confederate government tried to defend everywhere at once instead of zeroing in on what's the worst threat that we have in a military campaign. It's the large federal army in Tennessee, or now in Mississippi or Memphis or wherever, or now Sherman in Chattanooga, or the large federal army in Virginia. So take everything you've got. Forget about Bumfuzzle, Mississippi, or Podunk, Alabama, or whatever. Throw everybody you've got against these large armies. Destroy these large armies. Then you can go back and pick up all these smaller areas that have been occupied by federal troops that are pretty much just in the rear with the gear, holding on to small strong points. But you have to destroy these large armies first. They never would do that. They tried to defend everywhere at once, and they never could get a large enough concentration to take out Sherman, take out Grant. But anyway, that was the government strategy. So we have this large army coming out of Memphis. The main purpose, from the winter of 1864 until the summer, they sent four separate armies out of Memphis into northern Mississippi, and the only thing they were supposed to do was keep Forrest busy. If they could destroy Forrest and his command, great, but as long as they kept him fighting, you know, first this one, then army number two, then number three, then number four, and keep him out of Tennessee until Sherman could take Atlanta, that was the main overall strategy of the Federals. They figured it out a lot better than the Confederate government did. So we have this large army coming out of Memphis. Samuel Sturgis is the commander. The cavalry commander is under command is under Benjamin Grierson. And that may not ring a bell with it, our listeners out there, but if you go back a year before in the Vicksburg campaign, Benjamin Grierson was the one that made the ride out of Tennessee all the way down through sort of central Mississippi, dodging the Confederates at Vicksburg and Jackson, of course, and came all the way through Mississippi and wound up down at Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And this was the character that John Wayne used in his movie The Horse Soldiers, that was brought out as a for the Civil War centennial. And I tell you, the Duke would have done a lot better to play a real cavalry officer by the name of Bedford Forrest. So Grierson now, a year later, he's not running through a vacant part of the state. He's getting ready to run into somebody that's going to rip him a new rear end, as they say. So Stephen D. Lee would call Forrest, and so come back to Mississippi and defend that part of the state. And nobody was there to take out Sherman's railroads in Tennessee. The Yankee column was slowed by heavy rains in the first part of June, kind of like what we're having now. The roads were actually rivers of mud. By the time these wet, muddy roads were churned up by artillery and wagons and all the things it takes to keep an 8,000-man army moving, the infantry that came along in the rear was just walking through mud up almost to their knees to try to struggle through these roads. Now, Forrest had his command spread out all over. They turned around, came back. They were spread out all over northern Mississippi because they didn't know where Sturgis and the Yankees were going, so they had to try to cover everywhere at once. And if you can imagine them coming from the upper left down to the lower right on a map, as once they passed this point, they had said, okay, well, he's not going to Corinth. We'll pull those troops back and come a little further south. Then he passes this point. All right, they're not going to Rossini. We'll pull our soldiers back. And, you know, so he had to spread out and figure out where the Yankees were going and then start pulling his troops together. The Yankees were heading for the railroad, which is south of Corinth near Baldwin, Mississippi. On the 9th of June, the U.S. camped for that night about 9 miles from a little place called Bryce's Crossroads. And on the 10th, all of Forrest Cavalry had much further to march to be concentrated at Bryce's Crossroads than the Federals, who were only in one column. They weren't spread out all over the northern part of the state, and they could just march in one column right there. So at sunrise on June the 10th, Forrest was coming up from Baldwin, Mississippi. He told one of his officers, General Abram Buford, what his battle plans were going to be. And he predicted this battle exactly the way he was going to fight it. He told General Buford, we've been scouting them for 2 weeks. They're going to send their cavalry out first, and the infantry will follow behind. And that's exactly what happened. The cavalry was gone at dawn, and the infantry lounged around in camp till about 9 o'clock until the Yankees broke camp and started heading out after the cavalry, and said they'll send their cavalry out first. The terrain around there, it's heavily wooded and underbrush. We'll hit them, and they won't know how few of us there are. They will send back for the infantry, and they're going to have to come up a road that's narrow. It's muddy. It's been raining, and it's going to be hot as hell today. And that was his quote. And he said, by the time they reach the crossroad, they'll be worn out, and we'll ride right over them. And, Eddie, that was exactly how the battle was fought. About 7 or 8 o'clock, Forrest threw out his skirmishers in the woods, and they ran into the Federals. A battle opened, rifle fire between the Confederates and the Federals, and Forrest always fought his cavalry dismounted. He used the horse as a means to get from point A to point B in a hurry. But once they got to point B, they dismounted and fought his infantry. They weren't riding around trying to shoot off a horseback. They were down on one knee or laying on the ground and drawing a bead on the enemy soldiers and knocking them down.
Accurate.
Now what
accurate
Forrest
fire.
Did, yeah, a very accurate fire. And what they would do in the cavalry, every fourth man was designated as a horse holder. And you would take the reins of your horse and three other horses and take them to the rear or into a gully or behind a hill or something, get them out of the way because you didn't want the horses to be killed. And it was kind of interesting. The bits that they would use had a great big ring on the side of it. So you didn't have to hold a big wad of reins in your hands. You would run the reins of all four horses through that big ring. And so once you got those reins and pulled them, all four horses were going to go with you because you were pulling all of their heads at one time. And so they would go where you wanted them to go. So anyway, they'd get the horses out of the way. They'd fight on foot. And so what Forrest was doing, as men would come in, he would not attack straight ahead up the Baldwin Road towards Bryce's Crossroads. He would throw them out in the woods to the right, throw them out in the woods to the left, and the Yankees thought they're being flanked by a much larger army. So they kept thinning out their line.
Well, all right, gee, we'll go right back to that point as soon as we come back to this break. Everybody, be right back, folks.
Your daily Liberty Newswire. You're listening to Liberty News Radio.
News this hour from townhall.com. I'm Jason Walker. Authorities continue searching for the suspected gunman in Minnesota who shot and killed former State House Speaker Melissa Hortman and her husband. A second lawmaker and his wife shot and wounded. They're still hospitalized. A 57-year-old suspect identified as Vance Bolter, still at large. Drew Evans is the superintendent of the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. He says it's too soon to speculate on any possible motive.
At this point in time, it'd be premature. The question was, is the manifesto and the information that we have received, is their motivations? We are working diligently on that. There's certainly some indications within that, but there's not specifics enough. We have been, this is a very active and fluid investigation.
The Israeli military says the latest missiles from Iran have hit areas in and near on the outskirts of Tel Aviv. The country's trading blows following Israel's blistering attack on Iranian nuclear and military sites. Israeli military quickly noting that it was currently striking military targets in Tehran, where witnesses say they've heard a number of loud explosions. Also at townhall.com, former California Republican Congressman John Campbell says he cannot understand why Democrats seem to believe the riots in L.A. will become a major political victory.
I just don't see how people running around carrying the flag of another country, insisting that they not be sent back to that country whose flag they are waving, destroying property and injuring law enforcement officers. I'm not sure how this helps the left's cause.
And Campbell says the left appears to be under the impression stoking up more riots like the one in L.A. will boost the Democrat Party. More on these stories at townhall.com.
Hi, this is Rhett Rasmussen of besthotgrill.com. We make the Solaire infrared grills with one of the largest offerings of grills and accessories. Our mini, anywhere and everywhere portables are perfect for tailgating and grilling on the go. Our best-selling 27XL is the convergence of price and size. The 36-inch is the size most often specified by kitchen designers, and the Solaire 56-inch is the largest all-infrared grill on the market. Solaire makes accessories like griddles and steamer fryers to enhance your backyard grilling experience. Solaire also has an extensive offering of doors, drawers, and bartending centers to complete your outdoor kitchen. All Solaire infrared grills feature the efficient Solaire infrared burner that heats up fast, locks in the juices, and makes you wonder why you'll ever want to eat out again. Learn more at besthotgrill.com. That's besthotgrill.com. Solaire infrared at besthotgrill.com.
Hello, friends. This is Jacob from Blood River Radio. We call the kings into account and tell the truth to shame the devil on this show every week because we are of the firm conviction that our cause cannot succeed without true revival amongst the remnant, amongst that principled minority of the dispossessed majority. Now is the time to stand and be counted, to do like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who would not bow down to the false idols of their day, even under pain of death, like the 300 mighty men of valor who surrounded the Midianites with Gideon, or the 7,000 men that God told the prophet Elijah had not bowed their knees to Baal in a time when even calling fire down from heaven would not awaken our kinsmen from their slumber. If you are encouraged by our labors in the trenches for the kingdom and the cause of truth, liberty, and righteousness, I urge you to consider supporting this program. No donation is too small. We can do with thousands or even hundreds what our enemies and the powers and the principalities of this present darkness need tens of millions to do. So please donate today at BloodRiverRadio.com and help us take up the hedge and stand in the gap against the great evils of our time.
Step into the boots of the American West with Range Magazine, where grit meets grace. This is a front row seat to the stories, struggles, and triumphs of ranchers, farmers, and stewards of the land. From jaw-dropping photography to no-nonsense reporting, Range brings you the untold tales of life on the range. Whether you're a city dweller with a cowboy's heart or living life where the pavement ends, Range speaks to the soul of the West. Subscribe today at rangemagazine.com.
Are you ready to stand up for your community and support your local sheriff? Join the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association and become a vital member of the Sheriff's Citizens Posse. At CSPOA.org, we empower citizens like you through weekly webinars, arming you with the knowledge to back your constitutional county sheriff. Together, we can uphold our Constitution and ensure liberty and justice for all. Your community needs you now more than ever.
Dear Blood River Radio family, thank you so much for holding on. You probably didn't even know we had difficulties here, but we survived thanks to Miss Lizzie. And the show must go on. So we're in the show must go on. We're back to the bitter end of Gene Andrews. I can't wait to hear the rest of this story, people. It's
okay,
true history, what he's telling you.
At Bryce's Crossroads, it's been called the perfect battle. It's a battle that's studied in military schools all over the world. And we got to the morning, about 8 o'clock in the morning, the Confederates ran into the Federal cavalry that was coming up the road, and what Forrest's strategy was to spread his lines way out through these woods, and they couldn't tell how many people were attacking them. They estimated the Confederate strength at about 10 to 20,000, and they had 3,800. But the 3,800 didn't get there till late in the afternoon when the battle was almost over. So anyway, but speaking of Forrest, and before I forget, and you have to poke me with a stick over the phone line here, we want to ask or announce and remind our listeners that this Saturday coming up, the 21st, is our 23rd annual Forrest Homecoming and Southern History Festival, Southern Heritage Festival, at the Nathan Bedford Forrest Boyhood Home in Chapel Hill, Tennessee. And this is an all-day event that we have from 9 till about 3:30 or 4, and they have artillery and infantry reenactors. We have history speakers. We have music. We have a whole area full of vendors that are selling flags and books and all sorts of things to eat and different items like that. And all of the money that we raise there goes to the restoration work of the maintenance of the Nathan Bedford Forrest Boyhood Home in Chapel Hill, Tennessee. So we hope some folks can come by, and it's a great day for all Confederate items. You know, you don't have to apologize. You don't have to worry about some goofball mayor shutting the thing down on the morning of the event. It's the land is owned by the Sons of Confederate Veterans. So we fly our battle flags there, and it's just a kind of like a family reunion every year. And everybody's glad to just sit around, see Confederate items, Confederate history, and not have to worry about a bunch of goofballs coming out there and messing with you. And somebody asked me one time, have you ever had any problems out there? And I said, well, no, we have security. But then on the other hand, we've got cavalry. They could ride these people down. A four-legged horse can run a lot faster than a two-legged human. We've got infantry that could bayonet them to the ground. And the cannons, instead of firing just powder, could put nails and screws in there for canister, and that would wipe out pretty much anybody that's there. And I would be willing to bet about 95 to 98% of the cars in that parking lot are packing heat. So you that would not be the place to have a protest if you want to run into that. So anyway, that's this Saturday coming up, the 21st. Okay.
Gee, so we're talking about you'll be there. Can our people, Blood River Radio, are they going? Will you have time to shake their hands? Will you be able to meet people that come up there, Gene?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I'm there. I have all the high-tech jobs. You know, if a toilet gets stopped up, that's my job to go work on that. So, yeah, we'd love to have the people come out. Like I said, all the money, the admission, and whatever they buy, food or things like that, that all goes back to the Forrest home. We're not out there trying to make a buck off of it. So we're back at the Battle of Bryce's Crossroads. It's about 8 to, from 8 to about 10 in the morning. He was fighting the Federal cavalry under Grierson. And Forrest, as troops would come in from other parts of the state, he would keep spreading his line out further and further. And the Yankees had to keep spreading out through these woods. They could hear rifle fire and attacks from the right flank and the left flank, and they thought they were being outnumbered. And they did exactly what Forrest predicted they were going to do. They sent word back for the infantry to get to the battlefield on the double. And so they were pretty much running. Now, you think about this. It's 10th of June, northern Mississippi. It's been raining. The sun's coming up. It's hot. It's muggy. It's humid. And you got on wool uniforms. And you're running through mud to try to get to this battlefield.
My God almighty.
And just as he predicted, by the time the infantry got there, these guys were falling out on the side of the road from heat stroke,
vomiting,
exhaustion. And as they reached the battlefield, a lot of them just flopped down on the ground. They couldn't even move. So the cavalry, by about, you know, 10:30, 11 o'clock, Forrest got through driving them back. They ran through the infantry. Now, not only was the infantry disorganized when they got to the field, now they had the cavalry stampeding over them. So they finally fell back to the crossroads at the Bryce House, and they established pretty much a defensive position there. It's on high ground. And if you ever get a chance to go to Bryce's Crossroads, it's a great battlefield to see because most of the terrain looks just like it did in 1864. And they've done a good job with maps and signs and marking it, and you get a great idea of where the battle opened, where it was at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, noon, and so forth. And you don't have to work your way around a bunch of McDonald's or a Walmart sitting right in the middle of the battlefield or anything like that. It does look a lot like it did back then. So the infantry is finally there, what's left of it. The wagon train is pulled up there. And now the Confederates have been counterattacked. The Federals thought they had enough men to counterattack, and the Confederates had to stop that. And they had to draw their troops together as best they could to stop this counterattack. Forrest was out there in his shirt sleeves, and somebody asked him, was kind of kidding him, and said, "General, where's the rest of your uniform?" Like he didn't have that long frock coat that officers wear. And his reply was, yeah, he had on a white shirt and a vest and his sleeves rolled up. His reply was, "Well, you don't wear your best clothes when you go into a hog killing." And so he was right there on the line with them, firing pistols and moving up and down the line and encouraging his men and threatening his men and keeping them on line there. And this was amazing, too. His artillery was used to blast holes in the Federal lines. And John Morton and his battery and Captain Rice, they rolled their cannons over 3 miles that day.
Damn.
Not at one time, but 50 yards, 100 yards, 50 yards. They would double load them with canister, and that's these bags of these steel balls, and then fire it, and it made the cannon like a giant shotgun. And they would literally blast holes right through the Federal line. And when they were trying to get their heads back together after this shock and awe attack, then Forrest dismounted cavalry, like infantry, would follow in right between these cannon blasts and right into the hole that they'd made in the Federal lines and then turn to the right or to the left. So the Federals had to keep falling back. Now, a lot of historians said this was the first modern tank battle. And we're going, wait a minute. That's World War I, 1914, that tanks were first used. No, because that's how Forrest used his artillery. If you think about it, Eddie, a tank is just an artillery piece mounted on tracks. And it goes clanking along, fires, and then the infantry comes in right behind this tank in whatever hole that the tanks have made in the enemy lines. So that's what Forrest was doing. Way before the First World War, he was using his artillery as simulated like tanks to blast holes in the Federal lines, and then his dismounted cavalry or infantry would come in right behind this shock and awe that it hit the Federal lines. Now, there are stories, and nobody has ever confirmed this, but there's too many people that said it did happen, that during the 1930s, two German officers, Erwin Rommel and Hans Guderian, who was the father of the modern Blitzkrieg, came to northern Mississippi and studied Forrest tactics at Bryce's Crossroads. And they have had people that swear up and down that my grandmother told me that she talked to these two German officers that were there. We'll probably never know because, of course, General Rommel had to commit suicide, so his son never knew the information exactly, you know, what happened there. But that story is very, very prominent in northern Mississippi that people said, yeah, my grandmother and my grandfather told me there were two German officers there studying this. So anyway, we get in the late afternoon. The Forrest has pressed against the center of the Federal lines, but Forrest's attacks always came from the flanks or the rear. So late in the afternoon, he sends part of his command up to the north of the Federal line and part down to the south of the Federal line. And there was sort of a lull in the fighting, and he told them, when General Bartow makes his attack at the north, when you hear the gunfire, everybody's going for it. And so the Confederates up on their right flank, the Union left flank, launched their attack, and here it went. Everybody up and down the line started pressing forward, or the flanking movement from the southern end of the Union line started pressing forward, and the Union line started to break. They abandoned their cannon. They started back on a retreat towards Ripley and later on to Memphis, and it started out as an orderly retreat until a wagon got turned over on the bridge across Tishomingo Creek. Now, I've been there. We've stood down in Tishomingo Creek, and the top of the bank is taller than my head, which is 6 feet. It's about 3 feet above me. But what you have to remember, with all that rain, that creek was filled up. So it was up to the top of the bank. So when that wagon turned over and the bridge was blocked, now all these Yankee troops were trapped on the side of this flooded creek, with the Confederates coming over the hills and firing at them from both flanks and from the rear.
Well, I'll tell you what,
and we'll finish it up.
This is a battle between truth and deceit, a battle between forces that would enslave this country in darkness and between a media that wants to present you with the truth.
We are being censored. America's news outlets no longer provide the truth. 90% of news outlets in the United States are controlled by 6 corporations. The mission of the Epoch Times is to chase the truth, to ground all statements in fact.
TheEpochTimes.com.
This is Attorney Jason Robb, General Counsel of the Knights Party, based out of Harrison, Arkansas, and proud supporter of Blood River Radio. I, like you, am concerned about the destruction of our beloved America and our racial kindred people and our cherished liberties. As an individual and as a nation, liberty is what we seek. Liberty is important. It is what allows us to be independent, and if properly used, liberty allows us to fully worship God in all areas of life. And with that worship comes more liberty. We are on the verge of anarchy in this country, and personal liberty is looked upon as a crowning achievement of the people. However, Christianity and white law and order is viewed as the enemy of this newfound freedom, and that is why it is under attack. Learn more by listening to Blood River Radio every Saturday from 4 to 6 p.m.
Looking for an IT partner that truly understands your needs? Managed IT Services is the answer. We meet with you regularly to discuss your goals and form a tailored technology plan. Our customers have called us a trusted advisor who delivers. When it comes to IT, we do it all. Firewalls, cloud storage, server migration, and more. Say goodbye to long-term contracts and hello to a team that earns your business month after month. Call 801-706-6980 now and let Managed IT Services transform your IT experience.
The Venus is a .44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, and would blow your head clean off. You've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
Here at Blood River Radio, time is money, and we're running short of both, so we're going to go right back to the bitter end. This is very, very exciting to me. I'm enjoying it as much as any of y'all at Aaron WMT. Go ahead, bitter end.
Okay, so we're late in the afternoon on June the 10th. The Confederates have been pressing the Federals back through the crossroads by the Bryce House. Now they got them flanked on both their left and right flank. And now Forrest told them, put the pressure on, everybody's going forward. He even told the horse holders, tie the horses off on some trees, and you grab a rifle and a pistol and get in this attack. Said, if we lose and you get killed, we won't need the horses anyway.
So, true.
Very diplomatic there. You know?
Yes.
He had a good grasp on the situation. So this final assault came from the Federal left, their right, and straight ahead, putting the pressure on them. They begin this retreat trying to get across this Tishomingo Creek, and what began as an orderly retreat turned into a rout when that wagon turned over and the bridge was blocked. Now the Confederates are coming down on the wagon park, where we remember we said they started out with 250 wagons. This was a huge number of wagons. And they were turned, the wagon park, the security was turned over to the black troops, the USCTs, United States Colored Troops. And remember, way back when they said that they left Memphis, they had these notes pinned on their uniforms saying, "Avenge Port Pillow, no quarter for forest men."
Sure, we bad.
But when they saw these Confederates roaring over this hill and firing away with pistols and shotguns and rifles, they couldn't tear those notes off of them fast enough to get rid of those notes. And going, Eddie Miller put it on me. I didn't put that note on me. No, man, I'm getting rid of this thing. And they took off in the stampede as well. So they're headed back up the road going towards Ripley and towards Memphis, and they're just abandoning equipment at left and right. A lot of the artillery soldiers cut the traces off from the limbers and cannons and jumped on the horses and took off for the horses that were pulling the artillery. They did the same thing in that wagon park. They cut the traces and used the horses to get away from there and left all the wagons sitting out there with no horses. And of course, now the Confederates, here's the thing about Forrest. Yes, he routed the Yankee Army off the field. I mean, it's one of the worst defeats that it was ever put on the U.S. military. But Forrest was like a bulldog. He didn't let go. And his troops were tired. They were burning up from the heat, just totally exhausted. That's tough. Get on the road and get after them. Because, yes, you're tired. Yes, your clothes are soaking wet from perspiration. Yes, you can barely stand up, but you're winning. And the same thing, the Yankees are tired. They're soaked with perspiration. They're, you know, on their last leg, but they're losing, and they want to get out of here. So a winning army always finds strength where a losing army is in desperate situations. So he was after his men, riding up and down the line there, encouraging them to go forward, keep the pressure on them, and they did. The pursuit lasted for 2 days. It took Sturgis 2 weeks to get from Memphis to Bryce's Crossroads. It only took him 2 days to get back because half of his command was either killed, wounded, or captured. He didn't have any artillery to fool. Well, he lost 20 of his 22 guns, artillery pieces he started out with, lost all 250 of his wagons. So he wasn't held down with any of that. And they were making a run for their lives to get back to Memphis with the Confederates snapping at their heels. And what Forrest would do in a situation like this, he would take the freshest troops he had, like those horse holders or some people that weren't really involved in the worst of the fighting, he would put them in pursuit of the Federal Army. He would let the other ones that had done most of the heavy fighting just drop down on the side of the road and get a couple of hours of sleep and rest up and feed and water their horses. Then they would mount up and they would head up the road at a full gallop. And the ones that were in the pursuit now, then they would stop and rest. And the fresh, more or less fresh ones that came up, they would take on the pursuit.
A shovel.
During that, just, you know, kind of relays. To keep the freshest troops on them. And they didn't know, the Federals didn't know how many troops were behind them. They knew that every time they tried to stop and make a stand, the woods and the fields were just full of bullets flying through there. And they believed that maybe Forrest did have 20,000 men that were coming after him. So they kept this pursuit up, and it got so bad that Forrest and his horse were walking up the road. Forrest and the horse were asleep. And some of his staff officers said, "I think he's asleep, and I think his horse is too, but the horse is just dragging his feet and walking along." Said, "You better go wake him up." And they said, "Oh, I'm not going to wake him up. You go wake him up. I'm not doing that. I'm not getting my head chewed off. You go wake him up." So the forest horse wandered off the road and bumped into a tree. And when he bumped into a tree, he kind of jerked, and it woke Forrest up. And he pulled the reins over and got the horse back on the road, and he went to pursuit again. One of the best quotes of the war came from the Union general, General Sturgis. He was heading back to Memphis as fast as he could go, and his other officers were encouraging him, "Sir, we need to make a stand. We need to get a rear guard organized. We need to make a stand here. Do something. We're going to lose our whole army. Do something." He said, No. "If Mr. Forrest," not General Forrest, but Mr. Forrest, "if Mr. Forrest will just leave me alone, I will leave him alone." But Forrest wasn't about to leave him alone. He was on his case all the way. So,
oh, Lord.
That was one of the worst defeats that the Federal Army ever got. in any war. And it just totally destroyed that army. But, Eddie, it served its purpose. So while Forrest was chewing up the federal army in Mississippi, Sherman was moving from up north where he'd fought Resaca in May and Tunnel Hill and then Resaca in May and into June. So now, June 10th, Sherman is moving down the Western and Atlantic Railroad past Cartersville, Adairsville, and toward the end of the month, they're going to fight the big battle at Kennesaw Mountain. Well, New Hope Church, Pickett's Mill, and then that was in the early part of June, and then the latter part of June, 27th of June, is the battle at Kennesaw Mountain. So, yes, Forrest defeated four Yankee armies that were sent out either defeated them or caused them to retreat back to Memphis, but he never got into Tennessee to destroy Sherman's railroad line and his supplies until September, and by that time Sherman had already captured Atlanta, and it was sort of a moot point. And that's when he decided he can't get supplies from the rear, so he has to cut loose from Atlanta, make a march across Georgia towards Savannah. So in a kind of a perverted way, Forrest was the one that caused Sherman's march to the sea, because he couldn't count on getting supplies, ammunition, medical supplies, forage for his horses, all of that down these railroads, because Forrest was the one that could go in there and take it out. Sherman and the Yankees recognized the brilliance and ability of Forrest much more than the Confederate government did. And Sherman actually said, that devil Forrest must be stopped, killed, or captured if it costs 10,000 lives and bankrupts the treasury. And that's how much he was afraid of Forrest and how much he thought, believed that they needed to expend any amount of money and use any number of troops to keep him busy and occupied in Mississippi and not let Forrest get into Tennessee and take out that Nashville and Decatur and Nashville and Chattanooga Railroad. But mainly it was Nashville and Decatur, because the Nashville and Chattanooga ran up and over Mont Eagle Mountain. And so that one was the one the Yankees used to send their empty boxcars back to Nashville or their wounded. Remember, they didn't have big diesel engines back then, so those steam engines couldn't pull a real heavy load up and over Mont Eagle Mountain and then down to Chattanooga. So the main line was just pretty much more or less level ground from Nashville straight down south to Decatur, Alabama, then over to Bridgeport, and then up to Chattanooga, which if you look at a map, it cuts around those mountains that are between Chattanooga and Nashville, swings down into Alabama and then back up into Tennessee. So that was our battle on June the 10th, 1864, a little crossroads in northern Mississippi near Baldwin, Mississippi. And if you get a chance to go there, they've got a really good museum in Baldwin, the little town that's right down the road where Forrest started out that morning of the battle at Bryce's Crossroads. And then, like we said, the terrain around there looks pretty much like it did in June of 1864. So if you want to, and they've done a good job now with maps and signs and things like that to really show you how this battle progressed during the whole course of a day. And it, like I said, it does look like the battlefield there. Unlike Nashville and Franklin, which have had houses and businesses grow up all over the battlefields, you have no clue what the Battle of Nashville terrain looked like or Battle of Franklin. Because the houses and businesses and everything have taken it over. So, yeah, if you get a chance to go to Bryce's Crossroads, it's well worth your time. And a lot of people go down and go to Shiloh, which is down on the Tennessee River, just north of the Alabama state line or Mississippi state line. And then you can hit Shiloh in the morning and go to Bryce's Crossroads in the afternoon. It's a good day trip.
You answered my question before. I was going to ask you that very question. Where would you go from Shiloh down to Bryce's Crossroads?
You can do Peter that. Ender, yep.
I don't know if every time I think you outdid yourself, you did it again on this show. Thank you so much for coming on, man. I've been on the edge of my seat the whole time, but thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Eddie, and thanks to our listeners for supporting Blood River Radio and listening to the program. Thank all of y'all out there.
And thank you for your donation this last week. That check, I all hate to crash the check. It's so beautiful. The check is a work of art, but thank you so much, Bitter Ender, for donation and your great letter. Thank you so much, Lizzie. Thank you so much, Blood River Radio family. Same time, same place next week. God willing, hopefully we can go broadcast them up to the Forest Home. See you. Good night, everybody.